Good evening. My name is Jay Levinson. I'm the director of the International Program at MoMA, and I'd like to welcome you tonight to our celebration of our new publication, Alfredo Bulton and His Contemporaries, Critical Dialogues in Venezuelan Art, 1912 to 1974. I should say there'll be copies of the book for sale after this event upstairs in the lobby. There are many people whose efforts were necessary to produce this book. I'd like to thank a number of them by name. It's a number of names, but this is sort of a family occasion tonight, so if you'll indulge me. First of all, our publications advisory committee, who were involved with the publication at every step of the way, Paolo Erkanoff, Luis Perez-Oramas, Juan Ignacio Parra, and Edward Sullivan. We're also especially indebted to our editor, Ariel Jimenez, for his complete commitment to this book and his really expert editorial skills. Jessica Hanke, the editorial associate, who gave Ariel invaluable assistance. And then, of course, the writers, many of whom are here this evening, who contributed really important new scholarship to our publication, Hugo Achugar, Roldán Estevagrier, Elias Pino Iturrieta, Marco Negrón, Luis Perez-Oramas, Sandra Pinardi, Macía Pinto, and Rafael Castillo Zapata. We were also fortunate to have generous sponsors, and I really want to thank them. First, MoMA's International Council. This is part of a series of publications sponsored by the International Council. We also received very generous support from Mercantiles Servicios Financieros, Ignacio and Luis Alfonso Oberto, the Reed Foundation, Juan Ignacio Parra, the Alberto Vollmer Foundation, Jean Hartley Bulton, Estherita Brodsky, Harry Manil, Gonzalo Parodi, Patricia Phelps de Cisneros, Byron Meyer, and William Bernard. There are also many, many members of MoMA's staff, too numerous to thank individually, but certainly our departments of publications, library and archives, the international program, our Department of Education, and I'd especially like to thank Gwen Farrelly and Sylvia Renner of my department, as well as several of our interns who all worked tirelessly, not only on the book, but also on the event tonight. And, of course, I really want to thank all the institutions and individuals and foundations and corporations, especially the Vollmer Foundation, who permitted the reproduction of the texts and the images in this volume. So since we have really quite an ambitious program this evening, I'd like to turn over the podium now to Ariel Jimenez, our editor, just to introduce him briefly as the curator of the Patricia Phelps de Cisneros collection and also of the Museo de Arte Moderno Jesús Soto. He's well known in Venezuela as an expert on modern and contemporary Venezuelan art, and his most recent publication is on Soto, a fantastic and huge volume that I saw for the first time this evening. So if I could introduce Ariel.
Good evening. Cuando Paolo Erkanoff le planteó a Jay Levinson la posibilidad de incluir América Latina en la serie de antologías documentales que había comenzado en el 2002, con el libro titulado Primary Documents, pensó en una serie de libros que pudieran recoger la obra crítica de tres personalidades sobresalientes: Mario Pedrosa del Brasil, Jorge Romero Brest de la Argentina y Alfredo Bulton de Venezuela. Pronto, sin embargo, el trabajo de investigación le hizo comprender a Inés Katzenstein, autora del segundo tomo dedicado a la Argentina, que una publicación como esta sería de mucha mayor utilidad si, en vez de presentar la obra de un solo autor, por muy importante que haya sido, recogía toda la documentación necesaria para dar cuenta de un momento en la historia del arte de los países considerados. Eso es lo que...
When Paolo Erkanoff spoke to Jay Levinson about the possibility of including Latin America in a series of documentary anthologies that began in 2002 with the book titled Primary Documents, a Source Book for Eastern and Central European Art Since the 50s, he thought of a series of books that would compile the critical work of three outstanding personalities: Mario Pedrosa from Brazil, Jorge Romero Brest from Argentina, and Alfredo Bulton from Venezuela. However, soon after this project began, the author of the second volume dedicated to Argentina, Inés Katzenstein, came to understand through her research that the use of a publication such as this would greatly improve if instead of presenting the work of only one author, as important as he may be, all the necessary documentation was collected to record a moment in the history of art of the countries considered for the publication.
Eso es lo que hizo Inés Kastenstein, con mucho tino, al estudiar la escena argentina de los años 60.
This is what Inés did with great insight when she studied the Argentinian art scene from the 1970s.
Luego, cuando Pablo Erkenhoff y Jay Levinson me invitan a trabajar como editor de un tercer tomo dedicado a la obra de Alfredo Bulton.
Later, when Paulo Erkenhoff and Jay Levinson invited me to work as editor of a third volume dedicated to the work of Alfredo Bulton,
me enfrento a una situación similar. Bulton había dejado una obra demasiado extensa como para reducirla a un libro.
I encountered a similar situation. Bulton had left us a lifetime work that was too extensive to condense into a single book.
Y nos dimos cuenta que incluso si llegábamos a hacer una selección de textos que hiciera justicia a ese inmenso trabajo.
And we realized that even if we made a selection of texts that did justice to this extensive production,
sin duda perderíamos la ocasión de hacer evidentes los procesos históricos que hicieron posible su inserción significativa en la escena venezolana.
No doubt we would lose the opportunity to make the historical processes evident, which is what made this artist's significant immersion in the Venezuelan scene possible.
Por eso, cuando Jay me plantea la necesidad de hacer un libro más amplio, aunque en cierta forma orientado en torno a la figura de Alfredo, crítica y historiográfica de Alfredo Bulton.
This is why when Jay suggested the need to make a book more comprehensive, even though still oriented towards the critical and historiographic production of Alfredo Bulton,
pensé que lo mejor era justamente buscar la manera de hacer evidentes esos procesos históricos.
I thought that the best thing to do was precisely to look for the way of making these historical processes more evident.
Analizando luego los dos primeros tomos, me dije que lo mejor sería identificar, por así decir, un corte o un momento en el devenir del arte venezolano que, sin ser tan amplio como el seleccionado para el primer tomo, ni tan específico como el de Argentina, diera cuenta de las principales líneas directrices que guiaron el desarrollo de las artes plásticas venezolanas del siglo XX.
After analyzing the first two volumes, I told myself that the best thing to do was to identify a period or moment in the evolution of Venezuelan art that without being as extensive as what was chosen for the first volume, nor as specific as that of the Argentinian volume, would still present the main guidelines that led to the development of fine arts in Venezuela in the 20th century.
Finalmente, el corte cronológico seleccionado, 1912-1974, resultó ser suficientemente adecuado como para lograr ese objetivo.
In the end, the chronological break selected between 1912 and 1974 turned out to be sufficiently adequate to carry out this wish.
Debo decir que una de las primeras reacciones que para mí funcionó como prueba de lo acertado de este corte fue la de Jay Levinson en una de las tantas conversaciones que tuve la suerte de tener con él.
I must say that one of the first reactions to this timeline came from Jay in one of the many conversations I was fortunate enough to have with him, and which to me proved how right we had been in choosing that particular time frame.
En un momento del largo proceso de producción, Jay me comenta la extrañeza ante las fechas seleccionadas, difícil o insuficientemente explicables desde una perspectiva exclusivamente europea.
In a moment in the long production process, Jay commented his puzzlement with the dates selected, which are indeed difficult or barely coherent from an exclusively European perspective.
1902, en efecto, no corresponde ni al nacimiento del cubismo ni al corte mayor que representó en Europa el inicio de la Primera Guerra Mundial.
The year 1912 does not correspond to either the birth of cubism or to the major landmark period represented in Europe by the beginning of World War I.
Que, por lo demás, esa fecha marque el nacimiento de la escuela paisajística venezolana, no podía más que extrañar a alguien acostumbrado a organizar de otra manera las líneas cronológicas de lo moderno.
This date marks the birth of the Venezuelan school of landscape art and will no doubt puzzle someone used to organizing the chronological timelines of modern art in a different way.
Pues bien, ese solo hecho me indicó que si queríamos dar cuenta de los procesos venezolanos, marcados a la vez por una tan ineludible como significativo anacronismo, como por la aparición de inesperados y no siempre canónicos ejemplos de modernidad.
Indeed, this fact in itself showed me that if we wanted to account for the Venezuelan processes marked by such an unavoidable yet significant anachronism, as well as by the appearance of the unexpected and not always established examples of modernity, these were the dates that we needed to adopt.
Gracias pues a Jay, en primera instancia, por esas frases iluminadoras que ayudaron una y otra vez a precisar la estructura de este libro.
Thank you, Jay, again, for your insightful comments that time and again helped to fine-tune the book's structure.
Para mí, como editor, ese diálogo, esa extrañeza mutua ante las reacciones de cada uno de los participantes fue la más fructífera fuente de conocimiento, de placer intelectual y humano.
For myself as the editor, that dialogue and the mutual puzzlement to the reactions of each of the participants was perhaps the most fruitful source of knowledge and of both intellectual and human pleasure.
Y por eso no puedo más que agradecer la franqueza y a la vez el respeto con el que se dieron en el equipo liderado por Jay todas las discusiones que fueron necesarias para hacer concretar o para concretar este tercer volumen de la serie.
This is why I wish to thank the honesty and respect with which the team led by Jay contributed to all the discussions that were necessary to consolidate this third volume of the series.
Son muchas las personas a las que debemos agradecer, comenzando evidentemente por Jay y Pablo Erkenhoff, quienes pensaron este proyecto editorial y le abrieron un espacio de posibilidad en el MoMA.
There are many people that I must thank, starting naturally with Jay and Pablo Erkenhoff, who came up with this editorial project and opened the possibility of a space at MoMA.
Al consejo de editor, integrado por Edward Sullivan, Pablo Erkenhoff, Luis Pérez Oramas y Juan Ignacio Parra, quienes aportaron siempre las ideas más significativas.
To the editorial council made up by Edward Sullivan, Pablo Erkenhoff, Luis Pérez Oramas and Juan Ignacio Parra, who always contributed with the most relevant ideas.
Y claro, de manera muy especial a quienes trabajaron conmigo, tan estrechamente que se hace imposible separarlos de lo que funcionó realmente como un equipo de editor.
And of course, a very special thanks to those who worked closely with me, which makes it impossible to separate them from what was really an editorial team.
A Jessica Hankey, en primera instancia, por su rigor y su pasión, por el innumerable conjunto de veces en los que su extrañeza, unida a la mía, ante las que fueron nuestros respectivos puntos de vista, le dieron no pocos toques de verdadera interculturalidad a este libro.
First and foremost to Jessica Hankey for her rigor and passion, for the innumerable times in which her puzzlement and mine, before what were our respective points of view, gave this book numerous touches of true interculturality.
A los coautores Hugo Achugar, Rafael Castillo Zapata, Roldán Esteban Grillé, Marco Negrón, Sandra Pinardi, Elías Pino y Turrieta, Marcía Pinto Saloni, Luis Pérez Oramas y Carlos Palacios, por los ensayos que permitieron una lectura crítica y contemporánea de todos los documentos presentados.
To the co-authors, Hugo Achugar, Rafael Castillo Zapata, Roldán Esteban Grillet, Marco Negrón, Sandra Pinardi, Elías Pino y Turrieta, Marcía Pinto Saloni, Luis Pérez Oramas y Carlos Palacios, for the essays which allowed for a critical and contemporary reading of all the documents presented.
A los traductores, Cristina Cordero, Jane Hoffer, Catalina Ocampo, Carlos Riobó, Richard Mosca y Laura Pérez, por el riguroso trabajo de traducción, como las editoras Elise Nussbaum y Diana Stoll.
To our team of translators, Cristina Cordero, Jane Hoffer, Catalina Ocampo, Richard Mosca, Carlos Riobó and Laura Pérez, for their rigorous translation work, as well as to the editors Elise Nussbaum and Diana Stoll.
En muchos casos, en efecto, las discusiones que sostuve con este equipo profesional sobre el significado de un número considerable de términos y la mejor manera de traducirlos al inglés cuentan entre los más genuinos momentos de apertura intelectual al otro.
In fact, in many cases, the discussions that I had with this professional team on the significance of a considerable number of terms and the best way of translating them into English count amongst the most genuine moments I had of intellectual opening to others.
Gracias, en fin, a todo el equipo del MoMA, que en diversos momentos trabajó estrechamente con nosotros, en el Departamento de Publicaciones particularmente, y muy especialmente a Cristina Grillo.
Thanks to all the team at MoMA who at different times worked closely with us. A very special thanks also to Cristina Grillo in the Department of Publications.
También a Gina Rossi, diseñadora de este y los dos volúmenes anteriores de la serie.
And to Gina Rossi, who designed this book and the two previous volumes in the series.
Son muchas las personas a las que todavía debemos nuestro agradecimiento, y pasaría horas recordando sus nombres y aportes. Pero no puedo terminar estas pocas palabras antes de dejarlos con nuestros expositores.
There are many persons to whom we owe our gratitude, and I would spend hours remembering their names and their contributions. But I cannot end these brief remarks before leaving you with our speakers tonight.
Sin darles nuestras más sinceras gracias a todos los artistas, críticos de arte e historiadores, así como a sus herederos y nuestros amigos los coleccionistas, por habernos autorizado a publicar los documentos que forman el corazón de este libro.
Without giving our most sincere thanks to all the artists, art critics, and historians, as well as their heirs and collectors, for authorizing us to publish the documents that form the heart of this book.
A todos aquellos también cuyo generoso aporte económico lo hizo posible y cuyos nombres acaba de recordar Jay Levinson.
Also to all those people whose generous economic contribution made this publication possible and whose names were just mentioned by Jay.
Gracias a todos ustedes por su colaboración y su generosa ayuda. Gracias a Sofía.
Thanks so much, Ariel, and thank you also so much, Sofía Vollmer, for, and as in so many cases in this book, jumping in and helping us with all sorts of unexpected issues. Actually, thank you, Ariel, for your very kind words, but this book would have been completely impossible without Ariel and his exceptional talents. It sort of reminds me, there's a story that when Enrico Caruso was a young man, he went up to Lucca to visit Puccini, the composer, and to introduce himself, and sat down at the piano and sang, and Puccini listened, and then he said, "So, who sent you? God?" But the story could apply, I think, equally well to our moderator this evening, Luis Perez Oramas. He's a writer, a poet, and an art historian. He's the Estrellita Brodsky Curator of Latin American Art at MoMA. I think many, many things have changed, all in a good way, since he arrived at the institution. He's done many, many things at MoMA, most recently the exhibition New Perspectives in Latin American Art, 1930 to 2006, selection from a decade of acquisitions. And he's also organizing now a dual retrospective on the artists Leon Ferrari and Mira Schendel, the first major exhibitions of these artists in the United States, which will open in April of 2009. He's also had a large role in helping us in this publication and very graciously agreed to be the moderator of the panel tonight. So, Luis.
Thank you very much. Good evening. I am particularly glad to be moderating this panel, surrounded by long-lasting friends and colleagues, mentors, renowned scholars and authorities on Venezuelan art and culture. What Jay Levinson and the International Program have done with the collection of books on Latin American criticism is really outstanding. From my predecessor at MoMA, who was at the inception of this program, to the editors and authors of Listen, Here, Now, Argentine Art in the 1960s, the present book published by MoMA on the Argentine avant-garde of the 1960s, to the absolutely exceptional and brilliant edition of this book by my dearest friend Ariel Jimenez, alongside the tireless and impeccable collaboration of Jessica Hanke. There are no words to praise enough this endeavor and its significance. From someone who comes from Venezuela, and now I speak as a Venezuelan scholar or whatever, I can say that there is no such a book in Venezuela. that there is no a book that gathers the primary sources of Venezuelan modernism. So this is a real groundbreaking contribution. The third publication is in process, and it is no other than Paulo Herkenhoff, who will be overseeing this book, which will focus on the work of the most important Brazilian art critic in the modern times, the philosopher Mario Pedrosa. Now I will introduce our panelists, and first Hugo Achugar. Hugo Achugar was born in Uruguay. He's a celebrated poet and essayist who has published numerous works on culture, literature, and art in Latin America. He has published 10 poetry collections of his own work, among them Textos para decir María, 1976, Todo lo que es sólido se disuelve en el aire, 1989, and Hueso Quebrado, 2006. Among his books, we can mention La Biblioteca en Ruinas, Reflexiones Culturales desde la Periferia, 1994, y Planeta sin Boca, Escritos Efímeros sobre Arte, Cultura y Literatura, 2004. He has taught at universities in his native Uruguay, as well as in Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, Spain, and the United States. Some of us, we know for a fact that he taught in Venezuela, because he was our professor at the university and our mentor. In Caracas, he worked as a researcher for the Romulo Gallegos Center for Latin American Studies. He's currently a full professor at the University of Miami, as well as director of the Observatory of Cultural Policy at the Universidad de la República en Uruguay. Most recently, Hugo has been appointed National Director of Culture by the Ministry of Education and Culture in Uruguay, so he will be overseeing, among many other things, the Uruguayan system of museums, as well as all the cultural programs related to dance, literature, music, and theater in Uruguay. Welcome, Hugo.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay Levinson, for inviting me. Thank you, Ariel Jimenez, and whoever had the idea to invite me to collaborate in this project, which it was fun to do it, and I enjoy it. I should thank Diana Stoll to give the English version of my essay. I should have known better and ask her to translate this, what I'm going to read now, or have the geniality of Ariel to ask Sofia to translate my Spanish writing. So here you're going to listen something that was written in English. It's unbelievable, but it's tried to be English, so maybe sounds Spanglish. It's Venezuela from afar and nearby. I still remember how astonished I was with the wild imagination of García Márquez when I read 100 Years of Solitude in Montevideo, Uruguay, during the 60s. I believed then that the genius of the Colombian writer lay mainly in his ability to create odd realities only close to those imagined by surrealist artists. Then, in the mid of Uruguayan and Southern Cone dictatorship, February 25, 1975, I arrived to Caracas. It took me only a few weeks to realize that García Márquez had a not-so-wild imagination as I thought, and that he was just practicing not magic realism, but a plain version of the old and well-known realism. Although his work were located in Colombia, to me they became an introduction to the northern part of South America and the Caribbean culture, a region at that moment that was as alien as the world of Kurosawa's film were to most Uruguayan by the time of the exile. Thus, when I arrived to Caracas, and during the period I was not able to distinguish Venezuelan from Colombian melodies, for me, García Márquez's work were just a photographic version of the life and landscape in this South America, too close to the tropics for my Southern Cone upbringing. Later, thanks to my Venezuelan experience, I was able to distinguish different tunes within the Caribbean countries, as well as their diverse national themes and concerns. This experience allowed me to discover a major and common mistake, Latin America was not an homogeneous unity or entity. Venezuela did not allow me only to discover my previous misreading of what was Caribbean arts and cultures. What is more important showed me that Latin America was far more complex, diverse, and rich than I ever thought. In a certain way, even within some regions of Latin America, we have been trained in some sort of orientalism regarding Caribbean societies. Throughout history, many of the images of Latin America, those constructed both locally and abroad, have had a common tendency, a will toward homogeneity that erased national or regional characteristic, as well as a will to accept stereotypes as an undeniable truth. The reasons for this have often been political and economic. However, if anything characterizes Latin America, it is radical heterogeneity. Its geographic, ethnic, and social diversity, of course, but also its cultural heterogeneity, one marked by the dichotomy of oral and written culture, as well as the experience of living simultaneous temporalities or mixed times. In other words, it is possible to find various cultural, local, and economic temporalities coexisting within Latin America and even within a single country. The close to chaotic traffic of Caracas that I discovered in 1975 was just one of those faces, the faces of the region had and has to offer to anyone that tries to uncover the meaning of that sphinx named Latin America. Just a few hundred miles south of the highways of Caracas, you are confronted with huge plains and the craft and moors of the indigenous people, more or less contaminated with Western culture. This postcard that mixes city and jungle were produced by views within and outside Venezuelan culture. Different temporalities and different speeds in Latin America have made it possible for highways and skyscrapers to multiply in Caracas at an ever-increasing pace since the mid-20th century, while in other regions of Venezuela, which remain untouched by successive waves of modernization, not only indigenous groups, but many people still live on the fringe of the country's modernity. Nevertheless, as I said before, to reduce Latin America or Venezuela to the dichotomy of civilization versus barbarism, the same Romulo Gallegos immortalized in his well-known novel at the end of the 20s, it's not only a truism, but it's also misleading. Simultaneous temporalities or coexistence of diverse cultures does not necessarily suggest the confrontation of Western civilization versus barbarism. What it refers is to the intricate cultural system that makes these societies transcultural nations. A transcultural society is one that merges different original cultures into a new one, in this case, one that is not either Western or non-Western, but a unique culture, a culture that has created something different from the many cultures it came out. In Venezuela, differences and tensions are played out not only between diverse ethnic backgrounds, but also between the city and the countryside, the literate and the illiterate, the cosmopolitan and the provincial, and even within each of these categories. Thus, the cosmopolitan may be illiterate and rural. The urban may be provincial and literate. This heterogeneity of scenarios is not a recent phenomenon, although it intensified itself throughout the 20th century and now, at the start of the 21st, goes hand in hand with the current technological media and audiovisual revolution. Situating Venezuela within the diversity and heterogeneity of Latin America poses two risks. First, the risk of committing the sin of exceptionalism, common to all nations and nationalism. Second, the risk of failing to recognize the particularities of a country that is itself multiple and heterogeneous. Any attempt to make homogeneous assertions about a nation that harbors the Andean foothills, long stretches of Caribbean coast, wide plains, and the northern section of the Amazon basin, plus extremely ethnic diverse population, is destined to fail. However, the many Venezuelan cultures do possess certain traits that distinguish them from the rest of Latin America. These result from the interrelation of natural, demographic, and social circumstances, and from the fact that the country has developed a particularly sophisticated artistic practice in close contact with Western centers of power, an important cultural industry of its own, and a popular culture that is diverse, secular, and both urban and rural. It has been a violent, passionate political and cultural history that constructed Venezuela's identity. In a country of extremes, there is no place or there is little room to resignation or melancholy, at least for most Venezuelans. This is not a minor issue. In a country with 30% of its population under the age of 15, it's understandable that passion and will to change have a strong effect in its cultural productions. Bulton's Venezuela, or Venezuela of Bulton. I never know which way it is. Bulton's Venezuela, Venezuela of the Bulton. That's my Spanglish, one of them. Venezuela is not extremely diverse because of its demographics and its landscapes. Also, social and economic differences help to explain cultural differences along with natural multiplicity. But to recall this intense and extreme diversity is not satisfactory when one tries to explain Alfredo Bulton's work. It is not satisfactory because Bulton himself dedicated his entire life to describe, to analyze, and represent the intricate variety of Venezuelan society. It is significant that the book we are presented today reproduces in its back cover, allow me, it is significant that the book we are presented today reproduces in its back cover the photo of a fisher's net Bulton took in the island of Margarita. While on the one hand, this net speaks of the ability or the eye Bulton had to represent Venezuela's popular culture, on the other, it shows the process of selection implying every attempt to represent the complexities of reality. There are always some fishes that escape through the net. Every representation implies evaluation and selection, and Bulton's multiple attempts to capture Venezuelan society show his modernistic vision, a vision nurtured by the avant-garde discussion of the beginnings of the 20th century and the artistic vicissitudes of his time. Alfredo Bulton was not just an art critical or an art historian. There is also the creative side of Bulton. His photos, and I recall now visiting the former foundation when the first time I had contact with these photos from the 20s and later on, it's just astonishing, the artistic quality of them. His photos are more than a documentation of what he saw throughout his life. They speak of his desires, his values, his views of how the world, and especially his homeland, should be. In this regard, Bulton's La Margarita, his book of 1952, an ethno-historical photo essay about the island off Venezuelan northern coast, is closer to artistic creation than to the photographic record he attempted to achieve. The book is equally a detailed and carefully documented historical account and a photographic record with ethnographic ambitions, both of which are brought together through a modernist aesthetic. Nature, everyday subject, and human being are treated not only in terms of their referential value, that is, as documents, but also as aestheticized images or objects viable in and of themselves. Two good samples of this are the already mentioned fisherman's net in the aerial photograph of Margarita Island, in which the real object is defamiliarized and attributed the status of an artistic object. 30 years later, in the early 80s, when his work was republished, Bulton felt compelled to express how time and had changed the beloved and almost bucolic setting of the island. he nostalgically stated, and I quote him, "I would like travelers today to recognize the change that the island has suffered. I hope these images encourage them to prevent this harsh turn of events from becoming even more desolate and sterile. I hope they do their utmost to preserve and protect whatever still remains of the landscape and its people, for if it loses its current charm, the island will have lost its reasons for being." The quote, I love this quote. The quote reveals a love of popular customs, tradition, and the surviving natural landscape, and expresses a desire to preserve local values or authenticity in the face of modernizing forces. Bolton's sentiments betray the characteristic ambivalence of a modernity that he himself admired and celebrated in his essays on Cuvier and Soto, while at the same time proclaiming his adherence to the disingenuous naivete of Armando Reverón and marveling at the colonial cultural production of art and Venezuelan popular culture and the country's natural landscape. Bolton had an embellished view of reality tied to one of the faces of modernity, as Matei Călinescu would say. In that sense, his work is both an excellent sample of Latin American high cultural criticism and also a metaphor for the hegemonic notion of a culture at odds with the new urban mass culture or cultural industry's products. Thus, Bolton and his contemporaries' lifetime coincides almost strictly with that of the 20th century, or, as Eric Hobsbawm put it, the short century that began, according to the British historian, in 1914, though the book started in 1912, as we know, and ended in 1989. In this sense, Bolton, born in 1908 and deceased in 1995, was witness to the rise and fall of contemporary modern high culture. In 1909, Marinetti's Manifesto Futurista announces or signals the rise of the new modernism that opens the century. The fall of the Wall of Berlin in 1989 closes the 20th century. Its ruins are an addition to those of the violent changes occurred during the 60s. According to cultural critic Charles Jenks, modernity ended on July 15, 1972 at 3:32 p.m. with the demolition of the functionalist housing projects in St. Louis, Missouri. The nostalgia expressed by Bolton and numerous others between the end of modernity and postmodernity's beginning points to the inevitable state of every change in eras, simultaneous discontent, and the glimmers of future potentials. And the last part, and I'm finishing. On beginnings and endings, I am tempted to play the same nostalgic tune Bolton played since the Venezuela I used to live in is long time gone. Though nations and societies do not change from night to dawn, it is fair to say that there have been major changes in Venezuela since Bolton died in 1995. Chavez Venezuela has transformed many of the fundamentals of Bolton's Venezuela. All of them? I'm not really sure. What was already gone by the time of Bolton's disappearance was a society and a country that came into life with the discovery of oil wealth and modernized itself at an astonishing pace throughout the last century. But not all fundamentals of Venezuelan culture have disappeared. The unique character of its intertwined culture is still there. While researching for my essay in this book on Bolton, I visited Caracas 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Once again, I was marveled by the fresh, passionate, and enthusiastic character of Venezuelans. Once again, I realized that close to surrealist poets like Juan Sánchez Peláez were not foreign to the core of Venezuelan culture, as García Márquez was not distorting Caribbean reality. Once again, I recall the voice of a young poet asking me, "What did I miss from my time in Venezuela?" My answer was concise: your passion for life, your will to risk everything in order to enjoy life. Once again, the same old rain or palo de agua that surprised me in 1975 fell over my head one afternoon, 3 years ago. There were changes, no doubt about it. On a second thought, I realized that this new Venezuela, one that Bolton would maybe not have recognized, was nevertheless the same chaotic and passionate one I had the fortune to live in. Then, once again, I recall my old friends, all of them young poets to this day and some of them present today, amazed with the sound of a bolero, or mesmerized with multifarious memories of childhood, or with a broken tree or árbol torcido. My father, I'm quoting, "My father has arrived in his jeeps, and owls fly over him. The only mouse in the house rings 9 hours. I know it because at that time the mouse runs and crosses the living room." This fragment from a poem by Igor Barreto, among many other examples I could have chosen, continues to evoke, at least to me, the core of the multifarious faces Venezuela had and has in spite of historical changes. Father, tiger, jeep, owl, and mouse, all of them wrapped in the particular way Venezuelan culture mixes and integrates its disparate times, more, and cultures. This heterogeneous scenario is the same Bolton and his contemporaries tried to capture and represent. Alas, as we know with Lacan and many others, the real does not surrender to representation. Nevertheless, the attempt to do it was for a long time Venezuelan artists and intellectuals. For a long time, Venezuelan artists and intellectuals had been successfully trying to do for our immense pleasures. Many thanks.
Thank you very much, Hugo, for that beautiful text and words. We will have a session of questions and answers at the end of the panel, so I will introduce immediately Sofía Folmer de Maduro. Sofía Folmer is the founding director of the Alberto Folmer Foundation Research Facilities since 1993, which contain three significant documentary collections embracing key primary sources of Venezuela's 19th and 20th centuries, including the entire body of Alfredo Bulton's archives, the Folmer family archives, and those of architect Tomás Sanabria, who, for those who don't know, Tomás Sanabria is one of the leading modernist architects in Venezuela and in Latin America. Under her direction, the foundation has helped organize and sponsor numerous exhibitions of Bulton's photographic work and in important museums of Venezuela, Europe, and the United States. She has contributed to the publication of several books, including Fotografías, Alfredo Bulto, 1995, Iconografía del Gran Mariscal de Ayacucho, Alfredo Bulto, 1995, He Vivido por los Ojos, Correspondencia Alejandro Otero Alfredo Bulton, the correspondence between Alejandro Otero and Alfredo Bulton, that was also brilliantly edited by Ariel Jimenez in 2001. Sofía is also active in other cultural organizations. She is a president of the Caracas Chamber Music Association, Pro Música, and she serves on the board of the Fundación John Bulton, one of the foremost centers for 19th century Venezuelan studies. She is also on the board of the Fundación Alberto Adriani, which fosters economic thought and discussion in Venezuela. Welcome, Sofía.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here tonight. I've been set the rather daunting task of placing Alfredo Bulton in context and providing an overview of his important contributions to Venezuelan art and culture, all in 15 minutes, whereas it took 5 years, 15 authors, and nearly 400 pages to do it in the book, so I strongly suggest you read it if you want the whole picture. Not being a visual arts specialist, I shall not attempt to broach the subject from the expert's perspective. However, I was lucky enough to work closely with Bultong the last few years of his life and have since carried on the organization and preservation of his photographic and historic archives, so I do claim a certain intimacy with his work. Let's see if I can get this thing. Good, okay. Perhaps the most striking aspect of Bultong's work is the variety of subjects he was interested in. As one looks at his albums and reads his correspondence and the scrapbooks that Ugo was talking about, everywhere is obvious his natural curiosity, his industriousness, the enthusiasm and diligence with which he attacked each new facet of his research and each new theme of his photography. Without a doubt, Bultong was one of the most sensitive and cultivated minds Venezuela has produced. From a young age at the dawn of the 20th century, he was exposed to a very enriching blend of European sophisticated culture, the latest in artistic trends on one side, and the earthy, tropical expansiveness of Venezuela on the other. This duality, I suppose one would call it, this cultural duality, was evident throughout his lifetime and may have been one of the reasons for his deliberate attempts to forge a vision of the country as a whole, something that all Venezuelans could relate to and that expressed what he considered essential. In 1928, when young Alfredo returned to Venezuela after several years studying in Switzerland, France, and England, his photographic work was clearly marked by his two contrasting worlds. His series on called The Essays, Ensayos, has clear surrealist influences, which he attributed to Man Ray. These are carefully constructed scenes with contrasting artificial lighting and evoke themes from either literature or music, classical music, Greek mythology, various themes. And yet, simultaneously with these surrealist images, he produces another kind of image, totally bucolic, simple images of his surroundings, Caracas. And here we see no studio lighting, no technical artifice. These are just touching images of what he saw as intrinsically Venezuelan, the Caracas that would soon disappear under the rumble of bulldozers, of his friends, and of artists at work. This outwardly peaceful nation, under the ironclad control of one of our dictators, we seem to collect them, Juan Vicente Gomez, was about to experience an economic boom as strong as it was unexpected. And the younger generation was already dreaming of a different nation, one that they would have to build out of the rural reality in which vast countryside dominated the lives of its inhabitants. Bultong's early works are imbibed in this dream for the future. As a young photographer, Bultong answered this call using the means he had acquired in Europe, where he had seen photography used to express the daily reality of people as well as the interior world of the artist. With Russian photographers, he had seen their work actively used to build up nationalistic feelings. But literature also affected his sensibility. Reading Jean Giono's loving descriptions of Provence in 1933 triggered a series of photographic reactions and a desire to capture the as-yet-unknown landscapes of Venezuela. Thus, Bultong conceived an ambitious project to capture the totality of his country's landscapes and to make them known to his fellow countrymen. His wife, Yolanda, would accompany him courageously every step of the way. Following a process similar to Bultong's and other Latin Americans, writers and artists in Venezuela were also looking to express the same national reality by refining and to a large extent creating the symbolic basis of the nation. Mirroring the image that Alejo Carpentier used to describe Latin American authors, they set out to describe their surroundings and confront America like Adam did the world, for the first time giving things names. Like Bultung, novelist Romulo Gallegos dedicated a large body of his work to describing the different regions of Venezuela. In his novel, 1929 novel, Doña Bárbara, he describes the Llanos, Canaima in 1935. Chronologically, Bultung began in the Andes in 1939 and published in 1940 the book called Imágenes del Occidente Venezolano, the first book of its kind in Venezuela and what I think today one would call a photo book. Of all his works, this is perhaps the one where landscape is most dominant and where Bultung is most stricken by the beauty of his rugged surroundings. He has a very touching way of describing the most humble scenes. This is a chicken coop up there with the place for the chickens to go up so they can't get caught. The most humble details of its surrounding and its inhabitants, reminiscent of James Joyce's descriptions of Dublin. He adored. This is a La Luz, it's called, and the light is the wire. I think you can just see it up there that takes electric light to someone's house. He said he sat there for hours waiting for the cloud to be in the right place. Anyway, so where was I? La Luz. James Joyce. One can also observe Bultung's search for the prototypical image of what his cousin Arturo Uslar called local criollo beauty, that product of racial mixing that would become more and more patent as his work advanced. Two crucial aspects stand out in the following stages of Bultung's project. First, even though landscape continues to occupy a significant place, it is evident that his interest shifts towards depicting the inhabitants of the vast, intriguing nation. But then it becomes apparent that he's consumed with a desire to know more about these people and, in turn, about their history. Chronologically, we know all about her. Chronologically, Bultung continues his national photographic project with the island of Margarita, where his images take on ever-increasing anthropological value. That's the picture that Hugo was talking about before, where the islands become sort of ethereal. You don't know if it's a cloud or not. The central figure is still the fisherman, becomes the fisherman, his villages, his everyday life, his tools. These are the images that he exhibited in 1944 in the Museo de Bellas Artes in Caracas, and in 1946 here in MoMA when he was invited to participate by Beaumont and Nancy Newhall in the New Photographers show that year. His interest in the history of the country and the quest for images that could encapsulate the essence of Venezuela become even clearer in Bultung's 1950s publication centered around José Antonio Páez, the leader of the Llaneros, who were the plainsmen that were crucial in our process of independence. What better way, thought Bultung, of getting to know the Llanos than by following in the footsteps of that legendary character, Venezuela's first president. So, armed with Páez's autobiography, he ventured into the immense plains to meet the Llanero, to see him battling with the elements. And it is here that we can perceive yet another shift in Bultung's emphasis. His photographs are still his fundamental tool with his modern aesthetic, but as he becomes more enthralled in the nation's history, his images serve as a backdrop with the historical figure at the forefront. In Bultung's next book, La Margarita, published in 1952, the concept is of an all-encompassing history of the island, its discovery and settlement, the bygone days of the Pearl, old battlegrounds, and the daily activities of the locals. He becomes immersed in the subject, does all the historical research, writes the text, and with this book concludes what he calls the freeze on Venezuelan images, the imposing gorges of the plateau, the absolute solitude of the plains, this is a quote, and the happy, noisy Caribbean. Bultung now embarked on a new quest, that of finding someone who could fit the bill of a national identifying trait and yet reach the universally recognized dimension. And who more universal, in the sense that that word had for his generation, who more capable of contributing significantly to the history of humanity while remaining indisputably criollo than Simón Bolívar, the liberator, founding father of Venezuela. Los Retratos de Bolívar, published in 1956, is the first in a series of iconographic studies that Bultong published. From here on, he abandons photography for nearly 20 years and becomes immersed in his two historical passions, the little-known and often misconstrued iconography of the heroes of Venezuelan independence, and as a consequence of this, the history of visual arts in Venezuela. It is by no means a coincidence that his interest in Venezuelan painting was deepened by his work on the iconography of Bolívar, that exceptional figure whose life work endowed us with the origins of a nation. It is not a coincidence precisely because Bultong is following the same path that underlies all his life, the search for historical legitimacy and the desire to assert Venezuela's place in history and in the history of art, and to fill what he considered inexcusable gaps in our knowledge of our own past. The fact remains that Bultong began his work on the history of painting in Venezuela in 1958, as yet another dictatorship was in its last days. Very interesting changes were taking place in Venezuelan arts and architecture at that time. One of the most emblematic and daring works of modern architecture in Venezuela, the Hotel Humboldt, by Tomás Sanabria, had been inaugurated in 1957, conquering, as it were, the peak of the Ávila Mountain that dominates Caracas. Also by 1958, the Integration of the Arts project, led by Bultong's friend Carlos Raúl Villanueva, had been built in the Universidad Central de Venezuela. In the university campus, in the same spaces and with the same objective, coexist the architect's work and that of young abstract artists from Venezuela like Alejandro Otero, Pascual Navarro, Osvaldo Vigas, Mateo Manaure, and others from Europe and North America, such as Alexander Calder, Fernand Léger, Jean Arp, and Vasarely. It is easy to imagine the effervescence that of creativity that was involved and that must have been felt by all of the euphoria, as Hugo Achugar calls it, of having finally attained a modernity made in Latin America. Bultong and his contemporaries had further reasons to be thrilled. After the now famous Kinetic Exhibition in 1955 at the Denise René Gallery in Paris and the Soto Retrospective the following year in the Musée d'Art Moderne de Paris, there could be no doubt that Venezuelan artist Jesús Soto had finally reached international recognition rarely seen by a Venezuelan artist. Like many of his contemporaries, Bultong was convinced that Venezuela was finally in sync with art movements in the West and had something to say of conclusive historical value, and that in artists such as Reverón, Cruzier, Soto, and Villanueva, they had finally found truly universal Venezuelans. I love that picture. That's Villanueva, taken by Bultong. With his history of painting in three tomes and the many monographies he later published, Bultong created a perspective of Venezuelan art without paragon until now. He published over 60 books on the subject, and indeed he was the first to attempt a comprehensive analysis of the country's art from pre-Hispanic times to the present day. And to this he dedicated the last 40 years of his life. Apart from the absence of prior references, there were hardly any organized archives or systematic registration of works. His personal archives are a testament to his indefatigable spirit. There are myriads of letters to museums, artists, collectors, detailed lists of works and their whereabouts. It's very easy for us now to judge his work, but it is less easy to imagine the phenomenal time and effort, both monetary and physical, that these projects required. Never one to complain, Bultong would from time to time recount amusing anecdotes that led one to understand how few and far between were the historical sources, how uncomfortable the lodgings, and how non-existent the roads. In his criticism are reflected undisguised his preferences, his opinions, and his oversights, some voluntary, some not. Thus, understandably, he himself became the first and fundamental step for all who wish to study the arts in Venezuela. To use his own words, the geography of Venezuela took him to the history of Venezuela, always in search of that quintessential Venezuelan element, and always with that grit and tenacity that characterized him to his dying day. He took upon himself a titanic task when he could perfectly well have gone on the way he began, a successful businessman. and he left us the incalculable legacy of knowing more about our past and our present. I'd like to conclude using the words of a friend of his, Sofia Imber, and I quote, "All the nouns that relate to art relate to Alfredo Bulton. Critic, researcher, historian, curator, editor, collector, pioneer of modern photography, mecenas, and friend of all the great 20th century Venezuelan artists. How appropriate, then, it is that today we should be gathered here at MoMA to present this book whose guiding light for delving into the process of modernity is the work of Alfredo Bulton. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sofia, for this magnificent description of Bulton's visual anthropology, which is actually what I think it was, from his photographic works to his intellectual production on Venezuelan art later on. I will introduce Carlos Brillenburg. Carlos Brillenburg received his master's degree in architecture from Columbia University in 1975, and is a renowned architect, mostly known through the work of his own firm, Carlos Brillenburg Architects in New York. After working for Mitchell Jujola in New York and with Jimmy Alcock in Caracas, he started working in Caracas in 1980 and then established his New York firm 4 years later. His widely published body of work ranges from commercial structures in clothing theaters, sports centers, and the Yadro Building in New York to residential buildings and single-family homes. He has taught at the Universidad Simón Bolívar in Caracas and at the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies in New York in 1984 and 1985. He was also a founding member and director of the celebrated Instituto de Arquitectura Urbana that we all now remember in Caracas in 1977. He has organized conferences at the New York School for Social Research on Globalization and Architecture, Nature and Architecture, and alongside our former chief curator of the Department of Architecture and Design here at MoMA, Terence Raleigh, he organized a symposium Latin American Architecture 1929-1960 Contemporary Reflections. Brillenburg has received various awards such as 40 under 40 Architectural Record House Award and the Biennial of Architecture Award in Venezuela for a single family residence. His proposal for a new World Trade Center was exhibited at the American Pavilion of the Architecture Biennale in Venice in 2002. Thank you, Carlos, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Luis, for that lovely introduction, and thank you, Jay, for including me. I'm very honored to be here. I must thank Alfredo Bulton. The last time that I saw him in his desk in La Esquina del Chorro with his tweed coat and his very diligent way of receiving one and gentleness at the same time and amazing discipline was is an inspiration to us all and is the reason why we are all here tonight. So thank you, Alfredo. I'm going to attempt to make a talk about architecture during this time in Venezuela, not really by discussing what is usually discussed, because so much was being built in Venezuela starting in 1936, and continued on throughout the, I would say, up until 1985. I'm going to attempt to discuss the transcendent nature of Venezuelan architecture in the 20th century, not by looking at what to me is the most important work of 20th century architecture in Venezuela, the university city of Caracas, which was being built particularly during this time, this period I'm going to discuss, 1953 to 1954. We're going to concentrate instead on the work of two architects. Here we see Carlos Raúl Villanueva, and two houses, the house that he designed for himself, Quinta Caom and his family, a house designed by a Venezuelan architect for a family of four on a small urban lot. And we will look also at the Villa Planchar, which sits on a promontory overlooking the entire valley of Caracas, designed by an Italian architect for a couple without children. By looking closely at these two houses, we can view the architectural and artistic culture that was alive in Caracas at this time. The title refers to the concept of Gesamtkunstwerk, loosely translated as a total work of art. These two houses are preserved today thanks to the work of two foundations that allow us to experience the architect's intention and the role of architecture, art, and design in the domestic life of Caracas of this period. Quinta Caoma was built by Carlos Raúl Villanueva for his family in La Florida in 1953. It was a new urbanization towards the east of the colonial city that was developed in early 1928 by his father-in-law, Juan Bernardo Arismendi and Luis Roche, for the growing upper middle class of Caracas who were emigrating from the older residential neighborhood of El Paraíso to the south of the city center. The street Los Javillos was named for an enormous shady trees that line the wide pedestrian sidewalks of this well-planned neighborhood, which was designed by the architect Manuel Mujica Milán, a recent immigrant from Spain. The architecture of Caoma is deceptively simple. The ground floor is a three-bay open plan punctuated by a grid of columns that are then engaged into walls or left freestanding. The entrance, either through the front door or through the open space of the garage, leads into an entry space lit by an interior patio. I hope it's clear here. I guess I can use this pointer. Yes. This is the garage. This is the front door. This is the entrance space with this interior patio. And here we have the formal stairs, the living room and dining room area overlooking the garden, and the kitchen and the servants over here. And this is the second floor. You go up the stairs, and you have this various rooms. This the service courtyard on the second floor, and this grid of skylight that leads down to the patio of the entranceway. A separate circulation route for servants on the north side gives direct access to the back garden, the bathroom, and the bedrooms, and the kitchen or the stair leading to a laundry patio hidden on the second floor with direct access to the master bedroom. The second floor accommodates a family of four children with the usual hierarchy of bedrooms, bathrooms, a smaller nanny's room, and a library. The plan of this house is oriented towards the garden, using the elevation change in section and the diagonal inflection in the plan. This slight diagonal inflection here, you can see here and here, is makes the interiors less orthogonal and more dynamic. The openings towards the north are generous. The ones towards the south, the ones towards the south and east are smaller and controlled by louvers, and the strong western light towards the garden is filtered by the generous tropical plants that act as a buffer. Villanueva conceived the interior as a landscape formed by the intimacy of the relationship of the architect with the art and the furniture made by his close friends and colleagues. The traditional domestic environment is altered by the predominance of abstract art and by the non-specific placement of the furniture. The fluid arrangement of art objects and furniture determines the spaces more than the architecture per se. And this is a second layer of architecture, and this second layer of architecture and the landscape determines the settings for the social functions of the house. In some ways, Quinta Caoma is the antithesis of the Gesamtkunstwerk idea. Unlike the early houses of Frank Lloyd Wright, Carlos Raúl Villanueva did not believe in the house as an integration of the art of design and craft. The structure is a reinforced concrete frame using hollow clay block infill that is hidden behind white painted stucco. The details of the railing or the louvered windows are to some extent generic or vernacular. They do not call attention to themselves. They are very sensitive to the necessity of filtering and controlling the strong tropical light. Yet the extraordinary thing about this house is that the work of architecture integrates the art, light, and landscape. It is a very subtle design which succeeded in creating intimacy for friends, family, and art. In a way, the house becomes a recording, a biography of the life of the architect and of his family, and his very, very intimate relationship with the art objects that form this landscape. Here we see a portrait of Villanueva by Calder, and other objects and which are of intimate relationship to the architect. Many of them are models of works that have been built in larger scale and other projects, and a lot of them are as mementos of different moments in his collaboration with different artists. Here we see a fragment of Narváez in the garden. But it is a very unique house when you go to visit it because of the intimate relationship of the architect with the art. Here we have an example of the work of the architect. This is a sculpture which he made, which in a way is a synthesis of all the different tendencies that are present in the work of Villanueva. And here we have an architectural frame which creates a very specific space. And these objects within it also tinged by some sort of surrealism, as he did collect Cornell boxes, and also a kind of a reference to constructivist art. So you have an architect who is not really just limiting himself to the work of architecture, but he has a very profound understanding of the work of the artist and lives with this work in a slightly different way than we might as simple collectors, because it is his passionate relationship with the artist that he collaborated with that created a very, as you saw in the previous talk by Sophia, these extraordinary spaces of the auditorium with the Calder inside and all the other spaces of the university's city, which are continuous refreshments of the way that art and architecture can coexist and make something which is more than art, which is more than architecture, which still to this day sustains the culture of Caracas as it is heavily under attack. And now we come to the second house. This is a picture of Gio Ponti in Caracas in 1953. And Villa Planchar, in my opinion, is the best work of Gio Ponti. He was given a perfect site and very unusual clients who understood his architecture and who challenged him to realize his theory of finite form on this tropical promontory overlooking the entire valley of Caracas. This villa is very much a Wagnerian Gesamtkunstwerk in that the architecture, although abstract, is used to represent the idealized couple as portrayed by the leitmotifs of the sun and the moon. These two images are present at different scales in the from the ceiling fresco down to the plates designed by Gio Ponti and made by Ginori. The house is then considered as a temple dedicated to the union of the sun and the moon. These extraordinary plans that we see here drawn by Gio Ponti show all the possible positions of the couple inhabiting the spaces and the vistas of the house. So as you enter here, these are kind of octopus-like lines indicate certain circulation patterns, and then we have all these points where you can sit down and look out, and then these are the views that you may have or the relationships you have through the space, or the very, very idiosyncratic placement of these positions within this collection of spaces, which you will see now, creates a very interesting tension. This is the second floor, and we have, again, a sense of continuous space, but it is fragmented within very particular moments and views. Ponti's theory of finite form demands that each surface is independent of the other one. The non-load-bearing exterior walls are open at their seams and appear to float seamlessly or weightlessly. At the same time, these discrete spaces are defined by floors and walls as they exist within an open spatial sequence that creates an architectural promenade that is always alternating between interior and exterior. The result of this long and careful dialogue of the architect and client, as seen in the cablegrams and the illustrated handwritten correspondence between the architect and the client. This dialogue continues during the process of construction. Gio Ponti was present during the construction and changed openings to suit the vistas that he found in the landscape. At the same time, this house is an example, like the early work of Frank Lloyd Wright, of a house which was designed and constructed with flawless execution as a collaboration of architecture and craft. Ponti worked with his ceramic artists such as Fausto Melotti. Here we see the work of Fausto Melotti on the wall there. And not only him, but with other artists and craftsmen such as De Poli, Ri, Formasetti, Chiesa, Gamboni, and Benini, who decorated different portions of the house. The house then becomes a living museum of Italian industrial craft and furniture, which was mostly designed by Ponti. So it is truly a Gesamtkunstwerk. This is an architecture where the architect not only controlled the walls and the spaces and the light of the house, but also the design of the plates and the silverware and the furniture. It's a very unusual case. The house becomes a living museum of Italian industrial craft, and each element of the house is designed as almost as a separate element. Actually, let's go back here. This is the library, and here there is a. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture of it, but there was a very famous impasse between the architect and the client, because the client liked to go hunting in Africa and had this collection of animal heads. And Ponti could not stand these things. And so he designed these cases, which you see there, which have books on one side, and then pivot and exhibit the African trophy on the other side as a kind of mechanical theater. this house is also interesting if you consider it as an object of design, because each surface is so uniquely articulated as to really make the house not really a piece of normal architecture, but something that is almost from the outside, as Ponti liked to say, it sits very gently on the land, much like a butterfly. It is also somewhat of a Florentine villa with this generous cornice that you see that hovers in the air. And Ponti declares, and I quote, "Here, in the happiness of the tropics, modern architecture finds the perfect environment to flourish. In other places, architecture is a complicated refuge, a shelter in the landscape. Here, architecture is a wing under which one can live in an earthly paradise." This villa succeeds, representing the fantasy of the architect about man within nature, a nature that is contained and framed by the artifice of design and architecture as the container of all the arts. Anala Planchar declared that to live in a modern house, one has to be modern first. This house is a testament to her vision and her life. Here, as in Quinta Caoma, the art and the objects create a secondary interior landscape that was the perfect setting for the legendary collection of orchids, as well as the art of Morandi, Soto, Cruz Diaz, Alejandro Otero, Calder, Ledger, Arp, Vasarely, Varela, Narvaez, and others. In Ponti's own words, Villa Planchar is a very large and abstract sculpture, not to be seen from the outside, but to be seen from the inside, penetrating and moving along its multiple paths. It is made to be perceived by an eye that is in continuous motion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carlos, for enlightening us with the description of these two beautiful modern villas that we are lucky enough of being able to visit today in Caracas. I will introduce our last panelist tonight, Edward Sullivan. Dr. Edward Sullivan is Dean for the Humanities, Faculty of Arts and Science, and Professor of Fine Arts at the Institute of Fine Arts, New York University. He's a renowned art historian in the field of Latin American art, and he's widely acknowledged throughout Latin America as one of the most respected and quoted authorities in the field. His research ranged from Mexican muralism to Caribbean art, and from surrealism to the significance of the objects in modern Latin American art. He recently curated Juan Soriano and Modern Mexican Painting at the Philadelphia Museum of Art in February 2008, and was part of the curatorial team that organized Brazil, Body and Soul at the Guggenheim Museum in 2001. He has published numerous referential books and essays, among them The Language of Objects in the Art of the Americas, which is his last publication, and the monograph Emilio Bettoruti with Nelly Perazzo in 2004. Which won the Critics Circle Award in Buenos Aires for the best art book in 2004. Edward Sullivan is the foremost scholar authority in the field of Latin American modern art studies in this country, and a friend and collaborator here at MoMA. We enjoyed his constant advice and guiding while working on the magnificent publication that we are celebrating today. Welcome, Edward.
Thank you very much, Luis. And of course, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm sort of the lone gringo among my very distinguished colleagues from Venezuela, but I'm very pleased to play that role. And I, first of all, have to say how wonderful this book is. I had played a minor role in the consulting process with this book. I had very little else to do with it, but maybe I was the cheerleader for it. And I am thrilled to have it for many reasons, among them very selfish reasons, because it's a perfect book with which to teach. One can glean so much information, so many various theories about the art, so much practical information, and it is a wonderful model of an art historical book, and also very beautifully designed. So it's not one of these big, heavy nightmares that smother you when you try to read it in bed, like the catalog for Brazil, Body and Soul, which is why nobody logically has read that book. anyway, I was asked to do a very brief overview of what was it, who were the artists that Boulton was interested in, and what were some of the modern figures that most attract us today. The time period is rather odd, but not really so odd, because it's 1912, beginning in 1912, and what happened in 1912, I think that Ariel or Luis, I forget who said this, about the beginning of the landscape tradition in modern Venezuelan painting, but it was also something else very important that I think we can go back to 1912 as perhaps the year in which the oil industry begins to develop in a very major way. And, of course, that is the engine that drives the creation of Venezuela as a modern center, as one of these great centers for modern creation in the visual arts and architecture and painting and sculpture, etc. 1956, I was interested in the year 1956 particularly, and we saw actually why I was interested in it when Sophia, in her very, very beautiful and poetic discussion of Bulten, mentioned the year as the publication of Bulten's really major book called Los Retratos de Bolívar, one of his first, perhaps his first major art historical text, after which he continues to publish, and I want to make a couple of remarks about his place within an international art historical context in just a moment. Another thing I wanted to begin with, this very short little précis, is that we have become, those of us in New York, those New Yorkers among us, I presume most all of us, have become so sensitized recently to the art, much of the art of Venezuela, very happily, through a number of events that have happened here in Manhattan. Among them, last fall's very spectacular exhibition, and I must say it was at the Gray Art Gallery of New York University, my institution, after having come from the Blanton Museum in Texas at Austin that originated the Geometry of Hope, these masterpieces from the Cisneros collection, many of which, of course, the Cruz Diez, the Sotos, the Oteros, etc., were of Venezuelan origin. And currently we have a most beautiful and poetic exhibition organized by S.D. Brodsky, which you must all see, at the America Society on 68th and Park of Cruz Diez, an absolutely splendid show that, again, is a hymn to the great creativity of the modern contemporary world in Venezuela. And, of course, we have to use as a point of reference in the past few years efforts to sensitize those of us who are happy enough to be here and see the most extraordinary exhibition of Reverón here at the Museum of Modern Art. So Venezuela is very much in the news, as it were, in the art news and the art world sensibility of all of us, I think. I've been thinking a great deal about Bulten in the past 2 years since I've been reading the essays and reading much more than what made it into that book. If what had originally been thought to be in that book, it would have been about this thick. And maybe there should be other volumes of Bulten. But I'm very interested in Bulten, the art historian, and have been thinking about him in a larger panorama of people who were writing, say, from the 1930s up until the 1960s. It was in 1964 when Bulten began his series, a monumental series of three volumes about the history of Venezuelan art. We actually saw the portadas, the front covers of these books, a few minutes ago. The first of them is his book on Venezuelan colonial art, which was really a monument insofar as it had not been done. Many of the painters who were mentioned and analyzed in Bulten's book were even their first names or their last names were not even known before he did his archival research to create this book. But in a sense, more than anything else, the series of three books is about not only the history of Venezuelan art, but inserting into that history Venezuelan-ness. What is it about this art that is connected with the identity of the country itself? I know this word is very overused, this notion of identity. It really belongs to more of a discourse of the 1980s and the 1990s of identity politics, but I think it is very much worthwhile going back to this idea to explain some of the panoramas of the history of art in the Americas and in Europe that art historians were interested in looking at from the 1930s to the 1960s. I'm thinking, for example, of Antoine Pevsner, the great German-English art historian who, beginning in the 30s, began a series of books called The Englishness of English Art. I'm thinking, for example, also of a contemporary of Bulten, James Thomas Flexner, the American art historian and social historian, who also in the 50s began a series of books about what is it that makes American American art. And I'm thinking, for example, of José Moreno Villa, who in the late 1940s published a book called Lo Mexicano en el Arte Mexicano. What is it about Mexican art that is Mexican? So I think that Bultón is following in this very interesting trajectory of art historians who are examining the works from their countries to try to look both at issues of national politics, economy, sociology, religion, and connect them with the visual art. So it's a very interesting pattern that we see, a transnational pattern of interest in an art historical discourse of this time that Bultón is taking place in. I wanted to remind us, for example, in the first images here, I think I'm this is not done after 1912, of course, but Bultón, of course, was greatly interested, as we all know, in the colonial period and in the 19th century. For example, one of his important researches was done on the artist Juan Lovera. Juan Lovera, very interesting painter, not only in the context of a 19th century painter, not only in the context of Venezuela, but also in the context of the Caribbean. We often think of the Caribbean, I'm very interested in the Caribbean as a cultural construct, and we often think of the Caribbean as the nation, island nations within it. But the Caribbean is a much larger place, and Venezuela, the eastern coast of the Central American countries, Mexico, Colombia, play a very crucial role in that. Guyana and Juan Lovera, to whom Bultón dedicated a great deal of research and an exhibition, was a peripatetic painter, being very important in the history, for example, Puerto Rican painting. He lived in Mayagüez for a number of years and was very significant in that context as well. He helped to bring about a renaissance of interest in the colonial period. As I said a moment ago, the identity of many of these artists were established by Bultón in his Volume 1 of the three-volume series. We have here, for example, Antonio José Landaeta, or painting attributed to Juan Pedro López, both Virgin of the Immaculate Conception and the Virgin and Child. The history of Venezuelan colonial art is, I think, now today, in 2007-2008, receiving another wave of interest. And a great deal of this is due to, in terms of painting, in terms of decorative arts, in terms of furniture, due to the example of Patricia Cisneros, whose collection has been seen very recently in a very beautiful exhibition in Santiago in the Dominican Republic, and that catalog for that Venezuelan colonial collection. And many of these examples are on loan, incidentally, to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. So these efforts of the present years are carrying forth the legacy of Bultón in a very highly intellectualized way, which allows us to reassess what he looked at in the 1960s. So I just want to make that point before moving on to, and this will of course be simply a way to reacquaint yourselves with some of the things that he. I'm not pressing the buttons quite right. I don't think. I want to go back to what we were just doing. What am I doing wrong here? Anyway, all right. You saw very briefly Reverón's very early work. There we are. Thank you very much. So Reverón, obviously an artist who very, very much was on the mind of Bultón, and he established the chronology. The chronology has been, or the division into various periods of the blue, sepia, white periods, and his analysis of the chronological development of Armando Reverón was first established by Bultón. This has been, not, I want to say superseded, but this has been debated by a number of other art historians who are looking with a somewhat different eye at the chronological development of this very important artist. But be that as it may, Bultón was really the first to establish a sense of how we appreciate and how we can understand this very fluid and this very sui generis artist who in his earliest phases tends to incorporate a certain stimulus of his European experience. The 1920 painting of the cave obviously has references to symbolism. It has references quite directly to Goya and Las Majas de Goya, whereas one can look at impressionism and post-impressionism from a European vantage point, but ingested in what we could almost call an anthropophagite sense. sense of Reverón's going to Europe and literally eating up what he saw there and creating something that was very recognizably his own and very recognizably Venezuelan as well. And then we would proceed on to, if I can get this right, on to the more classic Reverón, which was so beautifully described by Bulten and seen some of these exquisite examples, particularly the light behind my arbor, mid-20s, seen recently at the splendid exhibition here at the museum now 2 years ago. It almost seems amazing that time has passed so quickly, and images such as this, this super evanescent painting of 1934, the white landscape, which allows us very directly to see how we must actually look at these things in person. I'm sure many of you had a revelation when you saw the Reverón exhibition, because so much of this work cannot be reproduced adequately in photographs. And as a matter of fact, as Bulten pointed out, so much of the texture of the often rough canvases, the application of the paint, sometimes very rough or sometimes extremely delicately, is as much part of the overall process and the object itself. We know that the object, as in the objects he Reverón created in the Castillete in Macuto, were as much the dolls and the crowns and the mirrors and all these things that created his own private world of reverie and fantasy were as much a part of his contribution as anything else. His last period, incidentally, which we saw a moment ago, being dedicated to often representing such things as the dolls that he life-size dolls that he created as part of his world. It's also important to look just very briefly, and this will only last a couple of more minutes because I know we want to have a question and answer. But I wanted to particularly for those of us who have been looking a lot recently at geometric abstraction, remind ourselves that there was perhaps not as large, but certainly a very present sense of figuration and in the work, for example, of Hector Poleo, who does very interesting art, much of it stimulated by his experience in Mexico and his relationship with Mexican muralists, the work of the paintings and drawings of the in this case 1944 Andean family, which is in a sense of an international idiom, as we can find such social realist painting in places as diverse as Cuba, Uruguay, Argentina, and here Brazil. There are a number of very interesting images that go along in the book, that go along with Bulten's interest in Narváez. And here, I think, a very beautiful representative example of the work of Narváez, who has been usually looked at in a Venezuelan context for his heroic sculpture. But in thinking about Narváez more for the preparation of this short essay or the short presentation, I was looking at Narváez from what I think is a very interesting international context, and looking at sculptures such as this 1951 piece as related to, let's say, interwar period, retour à l'ordre type of sculpture, the sculpture of classicism, the sculpture of Mayol, the sculpture of poor manship. If you go to Rockefeller Center, you see Prometheus in this very heroic proportions. It is that type of international style classicism of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s that I think Narváez was participating in. And I was also thinking, and sometimes these things strike me at the last moment, that the artist in a Caribbean context with whom he has the most in common is the Jamaican sculptor Edna Manley, who was the founder of modern Jamaican three-dimensional art. And there are wonderful dialogues and conversations which no one has ever said anything about, but I think I might start to think about it a little bit more, between Manley and Narváez exactly at this point in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And, of course, then we move into the, in a sense, the more mature period of Bulten's engagement with contemporary art and the number of artists who begin now in the 1940s, 1950s to go back and forth between New York and Paris, between Caracas and Paris, many of them coming to New York, of course, as a matter of fact. And it now begins this dialogue, this international dialogue between Paris and Caracas that bears such extraordinary fruit with the work of people like Otero Cruz Diez and Soto, and as well as others. And I think this is a wonderful comparison, actually, of 1947 and the 1950 work by Otero, just to see the radical transformation of the of his constant paring down to a point of abstemious geometric or quasi-geometric purity that was commented on so poetically and so eloquently by Boulton as in the case of the of drawings or the much more famous color rhythms, as we have in this work over here. Of course, when we get to the work of Soto and Cruz Diez, it is really more about the body, more about penetration of the body into space and space into the body. And in this, although both of these very beautiful pieces of the 1950s are really, in a sense, wall pieces, the things that are most well known of Soto or his Penetrables, in which one, okay, his Penetrables, in which one enters into a space that is created by Soto, so often very poetically described by Boulton, and it is Cruz Diez as well who participates in what we have just heard, this extraordinary dialogue that gains livelihood year after year, particularly in Caracas, with this constant communication between the plastic artists and the architects, making that city one of the most extraordinary modern entities, particularly in the 1950s. Cruz Diez, if you go to America Society to see this extraordinary show, you will see a number of the fisicromias, including the first of fisicromia that he did. And here I used a project for a mural because it is this mural work that brings him so much more into a public sphere. And it is the type of work that is only completed by the audience's conversation with it and encounter with it. Again, a concept that was very beautifully described and poetically made concrete in the writings of Boulton. And Gego, the same thing in a way. The idea of the constant interaction of the body, especially in Reticularia, this grand space and space-defining and space-recreating piece done by this German-Venezuelan artist beginning in the 60s and ultimately becomes one of the monuments, I think, of space-body art, if you can use that term, of the 60s, and this talent has hardly been surpassed. But I wanted to end this with a rather paradoxical series of two slides of Barbaro Rivas, an absolutely fascinating artist and who was so beautifully described and who Boulton beautifully described, but Luis Perez Oramas in his short but very, very, I think, densely written, and I use dense in the most positive possible way in the book, describing Barbaro Rivas and the interest that Boulton had in him as sort of the bookend, the alpha and the omega. If you use Reveron and Boulton's interest in Reveron many years before and his interest in the intuitive, I do not want to use the word, he was self-taught, I don't want to use the word visionary, but perhaps intuitive is the best word for him, an artist who is expressionistic, who is intuitive, and creating in these works a sort of desbordamiento of passion and sentiment that is in a way the ultimate logical conclusion of what Boulton had observed in one of his great earlier heroes, Armando Reveron. So these are just some of the visual preoccupations, I think, that enliven Boulton's mind and about those which we can read in much more eloquent terms than those that I've been able to describe them to you tonight in this glorious book. So thank you, authors.
Thank you very much, Edward. Well, I will invite our panelists to share the table here. and we probably will have a moment for questions and answers from the audience about these very interesting papers that have been read today. Ariel, come here. Obviously, you are the editor of the book. I don't know if the audience has questions. I have some questions that I can throw to the table to start the discussion, and maybe while the audience warms up for questions, I don't know if someone wants to present a question, or we can start a discussion here. I was thinking of that a problem that Hugo raised in his paper about the mixed temporalities and the dual temporality, that I think is a fascinating problem. It's a key issue in Boulton's work. And somehow it's something that he might have experienced as a troubling fact, but that determined his work, his interests, and lastly, his intellectual role as an artist, first, and then as an art critic. And somehow this question goes through all the papers that were presented today. It embraces the problem of two worlds, the two worlds, the two Woolton's worlds that Sophia raised. It is obviously present in Edwards' reading of that period in Venezuelan art, and obviously in this kind of problem that I try to address in my short essay in the book about Boulton beginning to thinking of an art as an art critique, working with Reverón and then ending with this kind of outsider, which was Bárbaro Rivas. So I don't know if you might, and it's something that, by the way, it's also implied by the University City project. Usually we stress the presence of abstract works at the University City, and then we forget that there is a core of figurative works, mostly in the interior spaces of the University City. And I was happy that Edward pointed out the athlete, which is part of that. So the two worlds, the two temporalities, are also inscribed in the University City project in Caracas. I don't know if you can say something, Ariel. Es el problema. I will translate a little bit the question to Ariel, de la doble temporalidad en la obra de Boulton y del conflicto de vivir esa especie de múltiples temporalidades.
I can understand that to speak.
Pero puedes hablar en español y te traducimos.
Yes, thank you.
And I think we all speak Spanish here.
¿Me estás preguntando?
No, I am suggesting if you can say some words about that, or Hugo, or Edward, or Sofía.
I would say that you just present an excellent paper, and I congratulate you. And I think I would add to this reading of Luis Enrique, which I found, as always, brilliant, that something of the sort could be even illustrated by the villas that Carlos was presenting. And I was fascinated with the presentation and the images of this dialogue between the nature. This architecture invading nature or integrating with nature, no? And at the same time, this contemporary, very contemporary art inhabited mainly in the Carlos Villanueva's villa with colonial images, and no, which was. The spirit of the avant-garde and the spirit of the modernist, but it was also the spirit of Boulton. No?
Well, I wonder, Luis, what exactly you mean by this double. I mean, is there really a true opposition between abstract art and figurative art?
No, I think it's more complex than that. I mean, that is a very schematic way to address the problem. And I mean, I think Hugo's introduction to the book actually gives a wonderful take on that problem, which is that there are several modernities. There is no a single modernity in Latin America, and that within each of those modernities, there are several temporalities in each experience. That's obviously something that marks not only Woolton's work, but all of it.
Well, I think in some ways it's very interesting to contrast and compare or continue the ideas expressed by Woolton's historiography of Venezuelan art and his attempt to synthesize the colonial with the modern movement, as also a concern which was very much present in the writings and the work of Carlos Raúl Villanueva. His very explicit search for synthesis from solutions of architecture that came from the colonial areas are very much fascinating and interesting, how he did not see any opposition to use these methods of controlling the light, which could be interpreted in a modern way through the use of concrete or other elements, but basically using techniques and technology which was very, very old, and not having that technology represent a particular culture, but something which was transcultural. So in a way, I wouldn't say this was about opposing temporalities. I would say this was more about a continuity of temporalities and a continuous reinvention of tradition through different means, but also recognizing the constants of the light, of the environment, of the nature, of the climate, which are very particular to Venezuela.
I think there's also another element, which is that Venezuela is not a country that leaves anyone indifferent, as Hugo was saying. And if you're profoundly accustomed to that, and like a lot of our artists and Woolton were, and they thought that was the way things are, and then they went to Europe, or maybe they could have come here, Miguel Arroyo came to the United States, there's a shock of realizing that that isn't the only way. And I think it's very difficult to get over that. And I think that in all this duality, it's something that we've all experienced. I mean, I experienced it the first time I went to Europe. And the other thing that also is inevitable, I think, for at least in Venezuela, is to have that nostalgia, because there's a lot of things that we wish to see modernized, and I'm sure that Bultong and all his generation wanted to see modernized, and then at the same time, that modernity comes at a certain cost, which then triggers the nostalgia, and we still see that today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, Hugo.
Just as a footnote to what Sophia was saying, it's the fact that Carpentier moves to Venezuela and to Caracas gets into the circles of Carlos Eduardo Frias and all this. And his idea of the Lo Real Maravilloso, the marvelous real, no? Mm-hmm. Which is not exactly that magic realism, but it's a little bit different. It's his response to surrealism. And I think that, in a way, Bult and was quite close to, not only to his cousin, Arturo Sarpietti, also to Carpentier. So the image and the puzzlement and the representation of what Venezuela was, or what modernity, the project of modernity in Venezuela was meant to be, is also in Carpentier's approach. It was something like zeitgeist in the sense of the spirit of the times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Is there a question in the audience for the panelists about the papers? Yes?
I think that the problem with modern and Latin America is that the artists wanted to be like in Europe. And when they went to Latin America, the reality wasn't that. It's what Octavio Paz says, in Latin America, the plane and the donkey coexist. And I think that is the problem, you know? To digest modernity, like in the Western, in Latin America.
Yes and no. Maybe I agree with you, but I think that Ed Sullivan mentioned something that I think that's key to Bolton and to the Latin American, the many Latin American projects, modernist projects and avant-garde projects. And it's in a moment in Ed Sullivan's talk, he it's hard to me to reproduce the anthropophagic. You said you. No, mm-hmm. you mentioned anthropophagic, which is a reference. At least I listened it in that sense to Antropofagia Brasileira, no, and this idea of not only going to Europe to get influenced by and returning and to see, but as Antropofagia Brasileira, the Brazilian avant-garde, put it was this idea of digesting the other to become more Brazilian, no, in a way.
And to create a modernity that specifically referred to one's own reality.
Exactly.
And actually, this series of comments, I think, ties up very well with what the question or the conundrum that Luis just posed. I also would see perhaps what Bolton was interested in, or the progress of the modernization, in quotation marks, of Venezuelan visual culture in the 40s, 50s, 60s, something as a continuing dialogue of the old binary of civilizazione barbarie, the idea of the refinement and the rough. You have, for example, I think about Soto, to take one of the artists that I just mentioned a moment ago. In the work of Soto, one sees extreme refinement. One sees extreme intellectual thought process and ethereal aestheticization coming into play. But at the same time, he creates things like his penetrables, in which one goes into it and one completely disturbs it and creates something that is very unhinged. So there's this constant, it seems, in many of these artists and in much of this, in the university city, in the houses that you mentioned. The houses are very rationalist and they're very calm, but they let nature come in. And nature isn't always calm. Those plants can go wild if they aren't cut back. There's always a sense of the competing tranquility and the irrationality at the same time. And I think Bolton was very conscious of that.
Thank you. Is there another question in the audience? Yes? No. There is an aspect that I think is fascinating in Bolton's work, and that was beautifully described by Sophia. And something that at the beginning of this process we were discussing very much here with Ariel and the authors, is that here we have someone who was a photographer, who was taking pictures of his own country, building series of pictures of landscape and racial typologies, and then there is a break, and then he starts producing texts and books and thinking of that country and building his body of works on Venezuelan art and culture. And we had the impression that his photographic approach to the country did set for him the program for his intellectual approach of the country. That, as he was interested in the typical bodies of Venezuela, then he was interested in the faces of Bolívar and Páez and Sucre. And as he was interested in this kind of Adanic landscape, then he was interested in pre-Columbian Venezuelan art. And something that I think it's interesting, I don't know if you have something to say about that. I think it's we were at some point thinking of Buldan as a avant la lettre visual anthropologist of Venezuela.
Well, I think another of the things that stimulated him, and what you say is absolutely true, is it's difficult for us to realize it now, but how little had been done. And I distinctly remember asking him how he got into all this, and he said, well, no one else was doing it. Yeah. I think he had a feeling of being in the designated sort of by fatality to have to do this, or else no one else would have done it. And some of these things have disappeared. I had a tragic conversation with someone from the Museo de Ciencias Naturales in Venezuela, who are the ones who have some of the best pre-Hispanic. Buldan didn't like the word pre-Columbian. He liked pre-Hispanic art that Buldan photographed. And they called us at the archives to see if we could give them a list of all the works of art. And I said, well, why do you need a list if you have the works of art? He said, well, we no longer have many of the things that Buldan took photographs of. So things disappear, break. The tropics is very rough on things. We don't have the same, I mean, the tropics and its inhabitants.
Here we go.
So I think he really had a sense, and that's why he worked till his dying day, because he knew that there were, as you said, a lot of fish come through the net, but he was trying to catch up with time and do as much as he could, and now it's for younger generations to fill in where he left off.
I like it, of course, all of Sofia's presentation, but I think that she mentioned just in passing something that should be remembered. Many of the present knows it, but I think it's what is amazing about Buldan is not only he's been either an anthropologist or art historian, magnificent for me, an artist as a photographer, and et cetera, but at the same time, like on the side, he was a huge entrepreneur, a successful businessman, and et cetera, et cetera. And so, and it's not minor. He's not just the kind of artist like Reveron, secluded in his world. No, he was an artist of many faces. So,
no? Well, I think just as a continuation of that same thought, he is, and also to point out something that Sofia just mentioned, that he was very much of a pioneer in the face of a nature which is at times poisonous and at times very dangerous. And at times cataclysmic, he felt the need to establish a history before it was all erased. Mm-hmm. And he felt the need to do this very quickly, and in some ways I think that he managed to create a culture of appreciation and respect for the traditions of visual art in Venezuela, which did not exist at that time. I was recently reading the catalog of Soto's exhibition here at the Guggenheim in 1975, and there's a beautiful interview there with a French critic, I can't recall his name, but he asked Soto, what made you leave Caracas and go to Paris in 1950 or 1949? And he said, well, you know, I was really interested in what was going on in contemporary art and sculpture, and here in Caracas, I looked at a Braque painting, and I was really very impressed, and I had looked at some impressionist work, But I didn't know what happened in between. I had no idea. So I said, "What is that why you went to Paris?" "Yes, that is the only reason I went to Paris." That's what Soto said. So, you know, we have to remember that although the 50s were an amazing time in Venezuela, the product of this newfound wealth and the construction of the university city and all the other great expansions and projects of Caracas, at the same time, these were all very fragile cultures. They did not really understand what was going on. In a way, the university city became understood 20 years later. It was not understood at its time. And even in the United States, when Calder has an exhibit at the Museo de Bellas Artes in 1955, he writes ecstatically afterwards, because at that time the museum could sell the works, that is his first exhibit where he sells every piece of work, and all to Venezuelan collectors, 1955. So it was not just a time of formation of culture for Venezuela, it was also a time of formation of culture in the United States. So, you know, it's very easy to think about these things as an opposition between a place of barbarism or tropicalism, but really it is a question of the formation of culture, and you have pioneers like Boulton, which makes it all much easier for us right now because we have all these documents. All the work has been done for us.
Thank you. If there is one more question in the audience, Esti, yes.
Your foundation, the Boulton Foundation, as well as the Villanueva Foundation, I think what's so extraordinary about both these men was their personal commitment to the artists themselves. Maybe that not only they were emotionally supportive, for those who they approved of, there's no question, it was a select group, but those who they approved of, they had an emotional and integral relationship with those artists as a collector and a friend, and the letters are, I mean, they're amazing, the level of intimacy that they had, and I don't know if our generation, well, there are some great collectors, but it's unusual to see that kind of commitment not only to the arts in general, but also individually, so we'd like more of those around. Thank you.
Well, I think I have been told by the gods of time that this has to end here and now. So thank you very much for your generous and beautiful presentations. And thank you, Jay, again, for doing this.